This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. Last Friday, Topuan Umasundari Sambandan Ni Subramaniam passed away at the age of 90. She was an activist, she was a social worker, widely regarded as a leading figure of the cooperative movement, and basically an all-round lovely person. Her husband, the late Tun Viti Sambandan, was Malaysia's first Minister of Labour and President of the Malaysian Indian Congress, or MIC, and he is regarded as one of the founding fathers of Malaysia. Topuan was one of the founders of the National Council of Women's Organizations, or the NCWO. And, you know, many people have said that, you know, whatever needed pioneering, Topuan was the one who was prepared to turun padang, as they say. And she made sure that everyone worked together as a multi-communal group. So her involvement with women's groups was to raise the status of women, and Topuan Umar sought to challenge conventional social barriers facing women, as she was a firm believer of women being in positions of leadership. And by working together with women of all races, she was able to address such social imbalances. So back in 2011, we here at BFM had the pleasure of meeting and speaking to Topuan in her beautiful home in Petaling Jaya. We had our then university student Kenneth Ng to interview Topuan, sort of, you know, getting the nation's youth to have a chat with the nation's elders, you know, just to sort of get each other's thoughts on where the country was going at the time. So here are some highlights from that interview, which was 9 years ago, which starts off with Topuan talking about the women's rights movement back in the 1950s.
Actually, we had very few local women's movements. The only one that did a lot of work was the Kaum Ibu at that time, the women's section of the AMNO. And they did an excellent job of making the people understand the importance of the vote. But most of them were Malay educated, or they joined. And it's an interesting fact that they had all the sandiwaras, and they're very good at fundraising. They even paid up the urine for the men. That's how they worked. But then at that point, we felt that their work should be known by the women in the big city. Our aim was basically what had happened in the government with the three parties getting together. We wanted the same unity to be established among the women. Because if you compare the nation to a bird, two wings have to flap at the same time for the bird to move forward. So we thought if one of the wings could be compared to the women, if the women lag behind, then the progress is going to be affected. For a free country, the women had to play their part, which means they needed the confidence. They needed to be aware of how important they were. Now, here I would like to mention very quickly, since we're talking about women, I think in 56, when he did his national speech for the MIC National Annual Meeting, my husband found a quotation from the UN Human Rights Commission, which was, you remember, the UN was formed just after the Second World War, and it was presided over by a very famous scientist called Sir Julian Huxley. He wrote to Mahatma Gandhi and said, "I want your input on human rights." And Mahatma Gandhi said, "I'm very busy going from place to place, working for interracial harmony in my country. I don't really know in what way I qualify to talk about human rights. But I can share one thing with you, and that's I learned from my wise but illiterate mother that all rights to be deserved and preserved come from corresponding duties well done. And all other rights are just usurpations." What he meant was, before you ask for a right, we should be able to do our duty properly. So we felt that if women unite and get together all our organizations, then each one of us had our own purpose, and also form organizations in a free Malaya then and then later Malaysia. Then we would know exactly what were the needs for women and children, and what were the shortfalls, and we'd be able to present it properly through the parliament and get laws made. We had many meetings with a lot of representatives from the different organizations that were already there. And I was the one who coordinated, because I had both languages. Because we had English-speaking organizations, you know, they were very sophisticated and they hardly had any contact. You see, this is our situation before the communication. We've always kept in compare. English educated, we felt a little more superior than the non-English educated in the kampongs or estates. Leave it alone, they never existed. The estate women were nowhere in the picture. The Chinese women were too busy working. the tin mines and all. And none of them ever believed they had any contribution to make except to stay home, bring up their children, work and supplement something. That was all. So we had to make them understand that they had a role to play. They were very important. Also, we had to get together first before we asked for anything. So that was how we formed the National Council of Women's Organizations. And every year we celebrated a Women's Day. We had conferences. We addressed many, many issues. In fact, it was our backing that we had our first woman minister in parliament, Tun Fatima. And she brought a lot of improvements in family law. For instance, she made non-payment of alimony punishable by law and basic things like that. And then she would go around from place to place telling the women there was no harm in telling the men that if they didn't pay alimony, they could be punished. There's no harm, you know, basic things like that. And then it went on to other important issues, not just affecting the women, but affecting family, affecting children.
Topuan, prior to independence, you were actually very involved in making rural women aware about the benefits of Malaysian citizenship. So, I mean, why did this problem actually occur, that they weren't aware of it, the lack of awareness?
Many of them had been here for many years. Technically, they qualified. But what did freedom really mean to them? They were like serfs in their states. The person who called the shots was not even God. It was the British manager of their state. And, you know, this situation was there till even 57, even afterwards. You see, I always consider when you read the history of rubber, it's more than 200 years now. They were here just to tap rubber. Now, before tapping, before planting the trees, what happened? When you, even now, you look at even the little forest between my house and the next one, how thick it is. When you drive along, say, Perak, you see the thickness of some of the forest there. Can you imagine a man with no t-shirt even, just a thing around his waist, with just a blunt, maybe an axe which he sharpens himself, and a mockery called a saw, no electric saw, nothing, no. With that, he fell down all those trees, dug the ground, prepared it for all these huge rubber profits, and that was the Indian, South Indian laborer who was bought. And there is written material. They were just decked, you know, in a boat. There's not even a room for them. No toilet facilities. Just dumped. And the agent or the Kangani is the man who supervises. He's also from the same kampung. He gets so much per person. So he goes and he tells them, oh, you're so poor here, already poor lah. And you come there, you can cover your five fingers with rings, you can just pick the gold off the ground. And they want a place very close, you know, for transport. They don't want to pay. So this Nagapattinam, they're just thrown into the boat. 6, 7, 8 days, they are dumped down wherever and sent to wherever they're working. And it's forest. It's a tropical forest. And this went on from 1850. And when they came here, of course, the reality was terrible. There are statistics. They died about 30% of virulent malaria. And the surviving people were the ones behind the rubber industry, for which the British were looking for huge tracts of land to plant, because that is when the importance of rubber as an industrial thing came. Coffee was no more, because coffee died because of virulent diseases, and they needed a new crop. Then they looked around this place, tropical climate, just nice for rubber. Now who would plant the rubber tree and tap and all that? Then after they came, first the women and children didn't come. Then they thought when they bring the women, they get more workers. And to this day, our women, it may not be publicized now, but the Indian women are the best women tappers. They're very good. They learn to tap. And they were also running families, you know. You have to tell them that they were the first women workers. You know how important women workers are now in the whole world. And they also gave the families that later voted for a free Malaya that important. So when the meetings are going on with my husband, it's usually the front rows for all we children, and then a lot of grown-up men. But there won't be a single woman, you know. So you go there and sit with them in the line, you know, the quarters, and they'll all want me to have a cup of tea. I can't say just one cup. Then I say, where did you all go there? I'm sitting all by myself. I say, what will we do? We are only women. We keep house. Morning we go to tap. Where do we have the time? I said, sit down. You're very important. Without you, there's no rubber. Ah, Nobody told us. I'm telling you, sit down. So you motivate them. You make them understand that they are important too. And then the question of citizenship. But what Tun Samandan used to tell them is, okay, now you want to go back to your kampong and finish off your days there, it's your choice. Because when they want to stay in a free country, he wants them to understand that's a choice. He doesn't say, you better become a citizen, then MIC will have more members and we have more strength. No, doesn't say that. He'll say, you can choose. But if you want to be a useful citizen of this country, you choose to become a citizen here. Then all these years of struggling here and working for the welfare of this country, you will be part of it, a proper part of it. And he'll say, if you do your part, if you do your duty, all that you need, education for your children, all the extras that you need to be a good citizen will come to you automatically. So at first I thought, what's he saying now? So he said, that's the way to make them understand that there is a lot of inner strength in them. You see, this is where he was a little different from the others. You see, when people have been treated like slaves for many generations, they lose that special quality that's a human being. I've seen people become more than subhuman, you know. The manager thinks for them, whoever pays them thinks for them. Even to do, they have to wait till they're told. They become so subhuman. And other things, I mean, nobody treats them when they're ill. They are dispensable. So from that thinking, you have to bring them out and make them understand that they are now going to contribute as citizens in a free country. So he felt that that was the only way to make them understand. No spoon feeding, make them responsible. And that is why he also believed that there's no need to go and beg for this or that or the other. Deserve it and stand on your own feet. Now, I'll just illustrate this. You see the anomalies about the Tamil society or the Indian society in estates. In Perak alone, $7 million of toddy revenue. See, toddy is taxed. Toddy and samsu are taxed, right? $7 million were contributed from toddy revenue. Who drinks the toddy in those days? So my brother-in-law gave them statistics. He said, look, this is your money. So you're not exactly poor. If you decide to save that money and go slow on toddy, then this money is all yours to send your children to school. Or, you know, so all that sort of thinking came because of the eve of freedom, because we had a party, because we were representing ourselves in the process of freedom. So our thinking was, let them understand that they have this strength in them and not always either ask for the manager or ask for somebody, keep asking for this and that and become a handout community. That was at the back of his mind.
We are revisiting an interview with Topuan Umasundri Sambadan Nis Subramaniam, a pioneering women's rights activist here in Malaysia, whose husband was the late Tun Viti Sambadan, who was one of the founding fathers of Malaysia. Topuan sadly passed away last Friday at the age of 90, and we are looking back at the interview we did with her back in 2011 to remember her and to remind us all, you know, of her priceless recollections of Malaysian history. And we're going to continue that after this quick break. You are listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Juliet Jacobs. So we're revisiting an interview with Topuan Umasundri Sambadan Nis Subramaniam. She was a pioneering women's rights activist. Her husband was the late Tun Viti Sambadan, who was one of the founding fathers of Malaysia. Topuan passed away sadly last Friday. And so we're looking back at an interview that we did, that we aired here on BFM, where she was speaking to university student Kenneth Ng, you know, sort of a nation's youth meeting the nation's elders to kind of discuss the state of the country as such. So here's some more excerpts from that interview, and I will let Topuan do the talking.
Tun Samadhan was actually one of the founding fathers of Malaysia alongside with Tun Tan Cheng Lock and Tunku Abdul Rahman. There's a saying which goes that behind every successful man, there's a successful woman. How was it like being actually married to Tun Samadhan? I mean, what were your experiences like, the challenges, the happy moments, all that?
Nowadays, the saying is a little different, no? They say, by the side. So, actually, Kenneth, dear, there's no real training to be actually a minister is a public servant. Every moment belongs to the people, if you interpret it that way. And I was going to tell you it was terrible in the sense one is never ready for what is going to happen, except when there's a lot of felicity and affection and Well, I knew more or less what to expect. That firstly, I'll never have time for myself with him. Okay, that's fine. Because when you love what you're doing or learn to love, it's okay. But one never knew what was coming. Because for a long time, our home was the party headquarters until we built our own place. So many people came and there were many problems. You just sat and talked to them. They needed somebody to talk and give them confidence. Just pick up the phone and set aside the whole thing. I've had students, and those days, transport, not like now. And my house in Guillemard Road, I will even pick them up, then we sit down, look at what they need. There were so few going for higher studies than for university. Fill up forms, write, apply for scholarships, all those things. So actually I was teaching before we were married, and he used to say, do you want to teach? I said, can I teach? We just started a family and then the whole party is now your family. So where is the time to teach? So, but then he was so understanding. He said, whatever you miss in teaching, let the students come to you. So I learned counseling. Each student was a new this thing in counseling. And I really enjoyed it. And you know, at the end of it all, you find they move along. And that's the greatest joy you can get. The same thing, you see, there was a phenomenon after independence. The British were not very confident that their plantations, the profits will accrue back to them. So this phenomenon called fragmentation was, any land broker would pick up a big estate, go around, show the plan, subdivide it, say 1,000, it's a small estate, 1,000 acres, subdivide 10 pieces. So each piece, 10% he'll collect and say, look, I'm going to purchase this. Would you like a piece? People who wanted to buy land paid the 10%. And he would then use that 10% and pay. He didn't use his money. And then he would organize the payment for the full estate. But then the estate would be broken into fragments. But the workers were our people. Our people meaning, I'm not being communal, but workers are basically the Tamil tappers. So what they would do is, they would have no job. Now, at that point, again, they would not know how to go out and do something else because they've been all their lives used to tapping. So there was unemployment. And there was legally no way of through parliament to stop these sales because it was becoming a communal problem. And this was the very first, very big problem that my husband faced after the 59, the first national elections. And many estates, it started in Sabrang Prai, then it moved on to Gedah, then moved on to Perak. So at that time we had Puli Man, he came and he said, when poor people want to move along, he said two races came to this country, very poor, oppressed in their original country, but one didn't remain as workers. They pooled their resources, bought land, and they became like rock. So any wind of change couldn't blow them off. But he said, you have remained like any wind of change can blow you. The only way you can become, follow that example, is pool your money in a cooperative way. This is the first cooperative society, the National Land Finance Cooperative Society, which asked for a ceiling of about $100 million. This is history in the whole world cooperative movement. And the first estate was hard work. After his regular ministerial work, he would go from estate to estate in educating them in this idea of forming a cooperative to buy their own estate. First of all, the workers didn't understand. They thought this was some other form, something like that. Then the registration was May 14th, 1960. And at that time, in Kedah, there was a 3,000-acre estate, Bukit Sidim Estate, belonging to the Earl of Bute in England. The first Earl of Bute was in charge of this famous Kew Gardens from which our rubber seeds came. So they said, oh, this estate will never be sold because they're very solid. But after some time, that estate was put for sale and the fragmenters started coming. Then my husband negotiated with them and he said, no, this estate is for the people. I'm planning to raise money and the cost was $3 million. I'm planning to buy it for them with their own share capital. Please don't fragment. We were very fortunate. The accountant of the agency to which the estate belonged, so he cabled them saying, take the bid from the cooperative because it's for the people. We'll see how the help comes. So we managed for 10%, that's 300,000. And then we had to get a loan from our own bankers, our personal bankers. This is where, when you're really devoted to something, you never give up. This is what I've seen in our life together. Can you imagine raising $3 million in the name of the people, where the share capital was about hardly 300,000? This faith and belief that it can be done. And within 6 months, the price of rubber was good, we paid back the money. But this is not a public limited company or a personal profit. It belonged to the workers who had contributed for the co-op. And this was quite a revolutionary. And Tunku was invited to open the estate officially. The toddy shop was closed and made into a library. So he made a joke about that with a twinkle in his eye. It was a very humorous stuff. And he also said, it's only in a true democracy like ours that such a thing is possible. After that, we now have Ismatun Samantan. When Shell building was 5 stories, and it was an exclusive thing of the Shell company, I think they, just this the year before he died, they negotiated for about 6 months. And I heard he had even a dream of a Shell before he negotiated. And they were able to buy this that building for the cooperative. By the time, I think about 65 to 70,000 and members, including Bhumis. This way, I like to say that we always had this non-racial attitude. Everything he did was national. Even though we supposed to be a minority group, the thinking can be very positive and high. Like the MCA also at that point of time, during Chenglok's time, it was basically people-oriented. The people in the small villages, you know, when General Briggs and Templar put them inside. I remember I came home from college for my first vacation and I said, Appa, how can they put the Chinese into fences? I said, they need land. They like to work on land. I was appalled, you know, and they had to be under those conditions. On this side, the communists were asking for food and threatening them. The punishments used to be terrible. This side, General Briggs, it was a tough time. So MCA basically cooperated with the SCA, the Singapore, and they were formed basically to help. Then they took up politics. So both the MIC and the MCA had this basic people's welfare, and they did not exclude the Malays. Everybody was included. That broadness of vision they had. I don't know about now, but I'm speaking for a time where I was very familiar.
31st August 1957, how did it actually feel like to you? I mean, what did it actually mean to you after all the obstacles that you went through?
You know, Canon, this euphoria is not a lasting thing. So you work and work and work. As I said, we've seen national movements. At last, it's coming true. Then the Duke of Gloucester, the Queen's uncle, is there to bring the instrument of independence. Our own function was on at 12 o'clock midnight, what used to be called the Slango Club Padang. I think when Tunku came down, the UMNO youth surrounded him and they wanted to give him a title. Actually, you know, historically, the clocks, before the clock struck, there was a delay. But then it all sorted itself out. And of course, everybody was very thrilled at that. I remember a lot of tears. You saw a flag going up first time and the national anthem. To this day, when I hear our national anthem, I feel that, you know, something you can't describe, you have to feel it. Your hair stands on end and start weeping and then some tears come, I don't know what. Nowadays, so easy to weep also, we have to be careful what we are weeping for. So it was a very special moment. Before the next morning at the Merdeka Stadium, we have achieved what we wanted. But those of us who had been given more responsibility, there was also a rightful feeling of apprehension, fear. Oh my God, can we deliver this to the people? Because it was basically from A, you know, so many things had to be done. There was no education, there was no health care, hardly any telecoms programs. The people were so sweet and simple. You have to carry this message to them. So I think I can speak for myself. I was only conscious of the fact that there was a lot of responsibility. What do you do at that time? I prayed. I said, you put me there for what? Make me do the work, whatever you want me to do. You, as simple as that, you know, it's responsibility. And you look around all these lovely people, leaving the political excitement alone. I got so used to that I don't want to see it, you know, for that moment. Doesn't last. Everybody has their own agenda and the thing. And you start looking at that, then, you know, you get sucked in. You don't want to go anywhere near that, because at the end of it all, we want to remain true to ourselves and to that divine spirit that brought us into being. So for me, it was very simple. Then I thought to myself, here, we means if he swears, I also am part of Hitler. When he was elected, he has sworn by all that's holy, the holy book that he believes in, that he will not use this position for self-aggrandizement. So I prayed that till the very end, God will protect us in that promise we have made to him. Very simple. Because at that moment, you can't say that I can do it. It's too big. can only depend on a higher force to see us through. I think it did. Mind you, we never complain. It's very difficult because the work with people takes so many forms. But if we can be equipped as it comes to be able to do it when we are given the responsibility, that's how I felt, yeah.
The May 13th incident, what struck you most about the incident, Topuan? And then, I mean, can you give us a scenario? How was it like actually at that very moment from a people's point of view, from a leader's point of view? What was actually the country facing?
You know, Kenneth, too much is made of that day. Lah. Maybe because it's the 13th. I don't believe it. It's not 13th Friday. It's May the 13th Friday? No.
No.
Even then, it ceased to have any significance. It's more than 40 years. Mm-hmm. Two generations, unless we tell them all the wrong things, they don't even have time to talk about it. They are a different generation. And long before May the 13th, if you read the parliamentary records of that period, people like my husband always warned them that the only way that our solidarity can be broken up was by communal division. Oh, the Malays are not doing this to the Chinese and Indians, and the Indians are this, the Chinese are economically trying to ride over us, which is not true. We know. But on the platform, there are rabble rousers among the politicians. Be careful. I always shiver when I'm in such a... I never go back. Because you know exactly why they are talking like that. And unfortunately, they get in. Don't know how. By now, we should be mature enough to keep them out. Or if they get in, let them talk. It doesn't bother me. That discrimination must come. With age 54 years, it doesn't take. But unfortunately, these people do get away with nonsense. We've seen that. It's still going on, Ladi. It's not just May 13th. It goes on in very subtle, negative ways. Okay, coming back. The one thing, since I was there at that time, and I'm very proud of what to tell you this, is that the father of the nation, Tunku, was retiring already. He had told everyone that the moment his nephew, the Sultan of Kedah, became the Yangdi Bato Nagong, he will step down. And that was that very year. Because he said, as an elder, he cannot sambah his own nephew. Mm-hmm. So decided he's stepping down. But it suited some people to say that he was going to be there forever. He wasn't. But what he did, instead of declaring an emergency and perpetuating that bad situation, they called the National Operation Council. I know the whole thing because my husband was very closely associated with Tunku at that time. So what Tunku did was worked very, very, very hard to recall parliament, to make the country peaceful enough and bring back parliament so that August 1969, we were not in a position to have a public celebration of independence. But August 31st, 1970, we were able to do that. Parliament had reconvened. And that, I think, is to be remembered. Nothing else. Meaning, this constant threat that another made, that don't use it as a political tool, you know. If they are nothing better, ask them to keep quiet. That is over. Over. And we brought back parliamentary. You look at any other country in the region. Has that happened? Did we have a prime minister who resigned when he was in power so that he could see a peaceful election? He actually made Tun Razak act as prime minister, and he went around campaigning in 1959. We saw that happen. I don't think in the history of any other free country there's been a prime minister who was in power who resigned and went campaigning so that we have a first peaceful national elections, and made very careful that there's no communal politics rearing its head. If at all there is a comment on 13, it was because people tried to use communal politics. So, to me, May 13th is finished. I don't think we should bring it back and just use it as a threat. I don't think it has any relevance to what's going on now. And I think the young people can't be bothered. They have already moved forward. They understand what is best for the country. So, what we can remember is that we brought back parliamentary rule. We had the maturity not to drag the thing. We also tried, of course, certain things to make amends may be difficult. It should never happen again. But constantly toting it out, I'm repeating this the third time because this is something that I feel very strongly about. It's not the way to do it. And especially people in power should never talk about May 13th. They don't know what they're talking about. They were not there in the first place. We were there. We know. And we are not talking about it. And here I'm not talking as a minister's wife. As any other citizen, you know, the birds stopped singing for that period. You think we were happy? We just kept blaming ourselves. What happened? What happened? Who wants to talk about it again? But quietly we went around helping. The very next morning I was taking food to a number of areas. I didn't take police escort. My heart was aching. We were involved in multi-communal harmony, our whole being. So I think when they just talk glibly about it, I feel, what are they saying? 40 years, it's finished. So many good things have happened. But we remember Tunku for thinking, he believed. You see, once we stood in the present Tunku, he looked at the parliament site and he said, Sambandan, this will be the symbol of democracy for this country. The man believed in what he was doing. Simple. No big frills around what he really believed. And everything had to be built after Tunku became prime minister. We didn't have anything in the country to show a free country. We built it. He built it with limited resources. And he saw to it that he believed in parliamentary democracy. He brought it back. If at all, that is what we should remember.
So Topuan, we've actually heard so many illustrious stories about Tunku Abdul Rahman. I mean, how was he actually like in person working with him?
He came from the royal family of Kedah. Mother is from the Shan state. She's not Kedah Malay. And she was a very prudent lady. She saved property for all the children that were born to her with Sultan Abdul Hamid. A lot of the property left to him, he sold to support AMNO. Because when he took over AMNO, he had no money. See, this is party politics. Parties have to be financed. And so you start by spending your own money, which is what Tun Sambandan did for the MIC and Tunku. I mean, see, this is where the three parties, though when they joined together, possibly they did not know each other very well. But it started by them knowing to work with each other. The common thing was freedom for our country. So they never bothered about differences. Another story about Tunku, he used to tell me that in the tradition of the Kedah royalty, they had Adilan justice, not the party, justice. Kamamuran is courage and valor and service to the people of the country. So he said, these are the three guidelines that I have followed from the time since he was born in that royalty. And to him, it was people all the way. And I remember the 10th anniversary of our independence, you know, Dataran Malaika, we reenacted the whole thing at 12 o'clock. The flag went up to the strains of our national anthem. And then everything was again restaged. And we were all there till about 2 a.m. because the people just surged around. It was like a big, beautiful garden with so many colors and different people, types of people all crowding around. And about 3-ish or so, quite late in the morning, we walked home. We stayed close by in the lake gardens. And Tunku's house is what, you know, now the Jalan Dato on where his museum is. The museum in his name is. So we followed him in the car to a certain point and then went home. Then very early morning, just about the time of morning prayers, you know, Azan, that's our usual practice. We went to Tunku's residence. Normally, Maungku, as we call Tunku's wife, she's Puan Sharifa Rodzia. We call her Maungku. And you know, the Kedah Malays, they've got a different way of pronouncing. Tunku used to call her Paya. It's Sharipa Rodzia. She'll say, yeah. So Paya, she'll say. So Paya usually waits there and greets us, and we greet her and waited for Tunku to come down after his morning prayers. And when he came down, we greeted him, and my husband said, it was very late last night. Did you manage to get any sleep at all or rest? And what he said reflects his love for the people. He said, Aya Sambandan, how could I sleep? I saw all that congregation of people. I just continued praying for them. And this is a man about whom people like to say that he was fun-loving, that he was this that la. He prayed 5 times, but he didn't wear it on his forehead like they do now. He didn't carry a tasbih in his car or do things like that. I'm sorry, I'm a bit cynical, but he never did that. But that man prayed for everybody.
Topuan, then moving on, you see, our country is actually founded based on various cultures and then it's various people. So do you think that with all this modernization, globalization, all that going on, do you think our cultures are still intact? Do we still remember ourselves?
What do you think?
I think that I partially feel that we actually have been very influenced about what's going on around in the world. As in, like, I wouldn't know how culture was back then. I wouldn't exactly know how it was back then. I would know how it's like in the books only. But the thing is, I feel that there might have been changes, but I'm hoping that it's because we had to change and it was for the better. That's what I think.
Good. You're right, because what I lived as the culture of my family is already different with my grandchildren. But it's a continuity. There's no break. But we still eat the same food, and traditional times we try to wear the same traditional dress, though it may not be every day. I think roots and culture more or less go together. And you're right, Kenneth, because the exposure of your generation is different from the exposure of mine. Mm-hmm. But there's still harmony. This world, it's full of changes. Mm-hmm. Nothing is static, right? And you see, take the example of Ashraf. Is it the boy who was attacked in UK? Mm-hmm. I bring it because it is a relevant current example. He's in London, one of the most sophisticated, huge capitals of the world. He's 20. But he's going to break his fast. That means he's following the traditional practice that his religion teaches him, is what his parents have lived for him. And then this happens. So then I felt his roots, his culture, wherever geographically he's placed, has remained more or less intact. And then the one different thing, which is very rewarding, is that so many people, because of the miraculous IT, the emails and the international contacting we are able to do now, he's been offered so much relief. And there's so much British Parliament. Everybody was appalled at the way he was treated. There's no communal approach to what happened to him. It's a human approach, condemning what was done to him and trying to give him comfort and make amends for what was done. I think that to me is the most marvelous thing in progress. I mean, we are getting there as one humanity. Whether you call it globalization, now what is modernism is passage of time, right? And how you change with the passage of time. Mm-hmm. So I feel very hopeful, like you did, that the very fact that we are able to communicate now is in itself an example for the fact that we both think the same way and we both have the same feelings for our country. And I don't see any danger or difficulty that's going to come and erode into our basic beliefs that in the process of living one's life, one has to harm somebody. Was it Nelson Mandela who said, resentment is the poison one drinks oneself, thinking that one is killing one's enemy. If we don't have an enemy at all, it doesn't come into the picture. Now we seem to be in a position where at least the balanced young people are moving towards that direction. I feel very gratified. Of course, there are many who have not had the benefit of a good family life or parenting. We have to think of them and do something. I think in this country, statistically, we are not such a big population. A big part of us are young, under 18, under 25, with fresh ideas, new outlooks. It's not of hope that we can make positive changes.
Topuan, last question. What would your advice, your message to the youths of Malaysia be?
I have nothing. Because this is a traditional question. You make me feel very old. I think it was Aung San Suu Kyi recently. She said, the fact that we achieved some form of independence doesn't mean that we guaranteed the right form of governance. So what are we showing to the young people? Are we making this country good enough for them to come back? See, we pick up cliches like brain drain and all. They must belong here. For that, I have always said this, we should be able to let them talk to us. What they want from here, what they feel confident. It's not just sending them somewhere for studies and expecting everything is nice. I know a lot of young people want to come back because their roots are here, parents are here, but sometimes they can't. And that makes me very sad as a parent because we are denying them something that will make them very happy. So you and I should look for a way of changing this, making this country a country that young people would want to belong to. And during this Holy Week, let us give our good wishes also to all our Muslim friends who are celebrating Ramadan. And may the right spirit and the right message go to all of us. I feel concerned, deeply concerned, that we've lost our vision. And everything that is being done by people with responsibilities done with in a short term, maybe the next election. What is 5 years? We must be looking at the next 100 years, because a nation is not built in 50 or 60 years. And the most important, valuable ingredient for the next is our young people. I'm not sure at this point of time what we are showing them. That concerns me a lot. So we need to ask them, and they can be free to express themselves, even if it is not the establishment line. There should actually be no difference as establishment or non-establishment. They should feel their belonging. It's not going to damage our country in any way, and that really pains me, because surely at the end of 54 years, where we should be really approaching ripe old age, now, if we have lived the proper way, of course. So we should be mature enough to let people express themselves and feel free to say how they feel. Then we'll get somewhere. Act as they feel also.
So that was some highlights from an interview we conducted back in 2011 with Topan Umasundri Sambandani Subramaniam, a Malaysian icon, an activist and a social worker who passed away at the age of 90 on the 31st of January. And I'm just echoing something that so many of us had said, that the country and all of us are poor without her. This has been Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.